This is All Things Considered on North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. I'm Jeff Tabiri. At a few minutes before 5 each Friday, we review the week in politics. Here for the conversation are Rob Schofield from the Progressive NC Policy Watch and Mitch Kokai with the conservative John Locke Foundation. Hi, fellas.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
A campaign announcement came on Wednesday when Anita Earls, an attorney who has been a central figure in redistricting challenges against the legislature, announced that she will run for state Supreme Court. Now, important to note, with judicial reform on the table, we don't even know if this race will happen for certain. But Earls is a voting rights advocate and a general thorn in the side of Republican lawmakers. Are there any concerns about an advocate potentially being on the state's highest bench, Rob?
I don't think so. I mean, truth be told, Anita has been a thorn in the side of Democrats in the past, too, and I'm not even sure if it weren't a situation where we have to declare our partisan affiliations to run for judge anymore. What, you know, she might even be an independent. Anita is a brilliant attorney who's had a long and distinguished career. There is a long tradition in our country of former advocates making the transition to being independent judges. Think of Thurgood Marshall, who was counsel to the NAACP. There have also been conservative judges who came from conservative organizations. So, I mean, Anita's one of the sharpest lawyers in North Carolina. It makes perfect sense to me that she'd be running for office.
I don't think there's a huge concern about it. And Rob is exactly right that many of the people who end up running for these positions are people who argued before these types of courts, and a lot of the people who get appointed to federal judgeships are ones who were advocates. Elena Kagan was often in front of the Supreme Court arguing on behalf of the United States government. So this is not something that's uncommon. I think what's interesting to me about this is that if the General Assembly moves forward with these proposals to change the way that judges are elected or selected, having Anita Earls as a candidate for what is now Barbara Jackson's seat on the state Supreme Court, the only seat up for grabs in 2018.
And a Republican.
This would certainly make it interesting if the General Assembly tries to make a change in that position to make it something that would be a retention election or some other change from the current system of partisan elections. Because if that happens, Anita Earls would be well situated to be a plaintiff in a case challenging any particular type of change.
Well, here's the other weird thing, of course. We've canceled judicial primaries now for 2018. So it's conceivable we can have a dozen candidates running, which is one of the wacky parts about canceling judicial primaries. And so, you know, the winner might win with 20% of the vote or 18% of the vote. So that's another wild card in all this. I think the official filing date isn't even till June, if I'm correct. So we're a long way off from knowing exactly how this is going to flesh out.
Next level here, maybe this is going to live only on the web. Earls made the announcement in front of Democratic headquarters here in downtown Raleigh. This is at a time when the judiciary is under attack, fair or unfair, for being radical and too partisan from a messaging standpoint, a political imagery standpoint. Was this a misstep? Should they have, and we're in the weeds now, but should she have done this in front of the state Supreme Court or elsewhere?
Well, we've moved, for better or for worse. I mean, we are now in an environment in which you have to affiliate with a party to run for office, to run to be a judge. If we had retained the system that we used to have in which it was a nonpartisan situation, I think you could make a stronger case that that would have been a big mistake. Unfortunately, that's the reality we have right now, and you need party support. I presume it's a way of sending a message to other Democrats, hey, got first dibs on this.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right, that by standing in front of the state Democratic Party headquarters, she's saying, hey, I'm running for this. Other Democrats who might be thinking about it, stand aside, because I'm going to try to lock up as much support as possible. I think it's also the case that Anita Earls, because of her high-profile role in challenging election laws and redistricting plans in North Carolina, would have had a hard time trying to present herself as sort of a middle-of-the-road candidate who's going to be someone that Republicans and Democrats can unite around. In fact, the Republican Party, right away, as soon as she filed, put out a very scathing attack on her, saying she was the nullifier in chief or something like that. So Anita Earls aligning herself with the Democrats is probably not a problem for her.
I want to touch on state redistricting briefly. Special Master released his preliminary maps this week. What were your takeaways?
My first takeaway is that if you take away all of the information about incumbents and where they live, you end up with district lines that look a lot more normal. I mean, that's what Nate Persily, the Stanford law professor, did with this plan. He basically changed the districts that the three-judge federal court panel told him to change, but didn't take into account at all incumbency. And he did that purposefully. He put out his plan, and then he ordered within a day for the parties in the case to provide the information about where the incumbents lived so that he could then say, all right, we have drawn districts that look basically fairly normal, hold to all the other redistricting criteria. Now we're going to look at incumbency, and perhaps we can change these districts to take into account the idea of not putting two incumbents in one district. But I'm not, as a special master, going to make that change if it makes the districts look bizarre, as some of the districts have in the past.
Yeah, I think he's provided confirmation that he's approaching this in a neutral fashion. I mean, there were some Democrats who obviously couldn't have been happy with how the maps turned out for them, incumbent Democrats. And he's sort of laying out some maps that are a roadmap for how to do this in a more nonpartisan, fairer way, which is what the General Assembly should have been doing all along. And I think it's also still just, you know, part of the process. This is not the final word. He's explained what he's done. He's put it forth in a very open way. He came in ahead of time. So it seems like to me another very positive step in this situation.
And one other brief note, you have to feel for Republican State Representative John Hardister, who moved so he wouldn't have to run in a double bunk district with another Republican. But now if this map went forward, would be double bunked with the Democrats. So yeah. Perhaps he's going to have another moving sign soon.
And I haven't checked Zillow in the past 3 days, but I'm not sure if he actually moved yet or if he had a home in eastern Guilford County. It was a rental. And he had mentioned that to me months ago. So
that's interesting.
He's got multiple properties. We'll wait to see where the maps are
finalized.
We won't
shed too many tears for him yet.
There we go. Meanwhile, Donald Trump's pick to lead the EPA's Chemical Safety Office is facing opposition from North Carolina's U.S. senators. Republicans Richard Burr and Tom Tillis said they will not vote for Michael Durson. Mitch, were you surprised by this opposition?
You know, I'm not exactly surprised by it, given the level of attention that North Carolina has had in recent months on this Gen X scandal. And one of the other things that was mentioned, especially by Burr's office, was the problem with the contaminated water near Camp Lejeune. And so the fact that this has been so much in the news likely had an impact on the way that both Senator Burr and Senator Tillis approached it. It is interesting, though, that they would come out in an outspoken way and talk about this, because it really is unusual for senators to speak out on something when there isn't a sort of direct impact. If Durson had been someone who worked at the Chemours plant or worked for DuPont, and they said, okay, well, you were actually directly involved with this, it would make a lot more sense. But it does show that they are keeping an eye on the issues that are important to people in North Carolina, see that this is one that on a bipartisan basis has caused quite a bit of concern, and thus are now responding to the concern by saying that they can't support this guy.
Well, from my perspective, it was a welcome step. Trump has been appointing a sort of long parade of paid-off flacks and shysters, people who should not even be in public office. We've got a federal court nominee in Alabama who's 3 years out of law school. He's been nominated for a federal judgeship for the rest of his life. He's never tried a case. He's a paranormal investigator. This is the sort of brand and the quality of a lot of Trump's nominees. And I think in this case, Burr and Tillis just said, this is ridiculous. This guy has been a paid-off spokesperson for the chemical industry. It's a classic Fox in charge of the hen house issue. And Mitch is right. This is an issue that's gotten a lot of attention in North Carolina because of the Gen X crisis. And it's just a bridge too far, even for Tillis and Burr. I wish they would do this in about 25 other cases.
On a different note, again, this might be something that lives only on the web, but on a different note, Mitch, your organization, the Locke Foundation, held an event this week calling for the end of subsidies for farmers. This is a $15 billion a year program or initiative. Your group supports free enterprise practices and generally opposes things just like this. It did strike me that many Republicans who are generally opposed to these so-called kinds of, you know, handouts, there are also many farmers who do support these subsidies, who are Republicans, who are fiscal conservatives. Kind of a general, generic question here. Is there an issue that comes to mind for each of you, from preferably your side of the aisle, where there is perhaps a little bit of inconsistency, but consistent inconsistency over the years.
Well, the first thing that this case really exemplifies to me is the fact that politicians, ultimately, all politics is local. I mean, Bob Dole, a conservative Republican for decades, a paragon of the Republican Party, was from Kansas. And so he supported farm subsidies and food stamps for poor people because it helped farmers sell more food and crops. And so, I mean, ultimately, politicians, you know, have to represent their local constituency. And so I think that's ultimately often the source of these kinds of inconsistencies. There are, you know, I don't know, countless cases in which I would say so-called progressives or liberal Democrats or even genuine liberal progressive Democrats have gone contrary to what I would view as maybe an ideologically consistent point of view. Obviously, progressive Democrats, especially white progressive Democrats, have a long tradition of discriminating against people of color. I think it remains a sore spot in the Democratic Party that there are issues in terms of people of color being wrongfully discriminated against and held back from leadership because of their race. I don't know. That's one that leaps to mind. I'm sure there's dozens of others.
Before I get to the main point that I'll make on this, just a brief correction on
our
event.
Okay.
Yeah, just a brief correction on our event. We weren't calling for the end of farm subsidies. We had a speaker from the Heritage Foundation who was drawing attention to the fact that the $15 billion a year program of subsidies basically aims many of these subsidies towards a small percentage of farmers in a small group of areas, and for not just for crop losses or for cases in which you have the some major disaster and so you're helping out struggling farmers. But there are programs in place that help farmers if they have a bumper crop. And you'd say, okay, well, you get a payment. And then they have a crop loss the next year. Okay, you get a payment. And so his idea was, if you're going to have these subsidy programs, let's make sure that it is for losses and not just, well, we didn't get as much revenue as we thought we would get this year, so let's get a payment. So
thank you for that clarification.
That said, probably the biggest one that I see is from among fiscal conservatives is for people who are constantly calling for lower tax rates, but then don't go the next step and say, but this also means that we have to have major control on government spending. Because basically, if you boil it all down on the terms of spending and taxation, most people like to have lower taxes, and most people like to have a lot of what government provides them. And there are very few politicians who are going to go to them and say, you got to make a choice. Either we're going to have this level of government and you're going to have the taxation that funds it, or you decide that you only want this level of taxation and you're going to get the smaller government that goes along with it. We can't go along year after year after year with having lower taxation than spending. They have to match at some point or else we're going to go bankrupt.
And that's indeed been the criticism that's been leveled at the current tax plans that are wending their way through Congress right now, is that it's, again, you know, pushing this notion that if we slash taxes somehow will magically erase the deficit. And in fact, the new, you know, the latest tax proposals in Washington are pointing to massively increasing deficits in the name of tax cuts mostly targeted at the wealthy.
One more question. This is admittedly hopefully a knee-buckling curve. Asked this to Loretta Beniti earlier this morning when we recorded the WUNC Politics podcast, and she gave me a look when I asked it. The top five political minds in North Carolina. Mitch leans back, and Rob's rubbing his brow. You jerk.
Well, there's three of them right here, obviously, at this point.
Well played. The top five.
Among politicians, prognosticators.
I'll let you take it wherever you want. Candidly, I thought of this question earlier this week. I don't know why. I was thinking current folks. When I asked Loretta, who's a television reporter that I'm sure a lot of listeners are familiar with, she actually went immediately to two folks who are, I would say, still strategists and political minds, but are not as active as they once were. And I'll tell you the four names we came up with. We didn't even come up with five when we recorded the podcast today. But it was just kind of a fun, lighter question, and wanted to see where your minds went in terms of you could go wherever you want.
The first name that comes to mind to me actually is one who's been in the news for the wrong reasons. But I would say one thing that the Democratic Party can look to as a reason why North Carolina didn't go as red as other southern states for years and years and years is the work and the political wisdom of Jim Hunt. Now, Jim Hunt's been in the news lately because some African Americans within the Democratic caucus are concerned about him coming out and making an endorsement in the Raleigh mayor's race for the candidate who was not describing herself as a Democrat. But Jim Hunt, for years and years and years, has helped North Carolina Democrats straddle the line between what North Carolinians will accept and what they won't accept, and keeping Democrats really as major power players. And I don't know if the latest election puts a chink in that armor, but he's always the first name I come to mind that comes to mind for me when you think of people in North Carolina who've been great political strategists.
Yeah, clearly I would agree with that on Jim Hunt. I think Roy Cooper is sort of, I've been amazed really in his first year in office that he's sort of, I think in some respects, sort of claimed that Hunt mantle. I would also mention a fellow who works for Roy Cooper, who's Ken Udy, who is an important player in the Cooper administration, sort of behind the scenes, but is a veteran of a lot of political wars in North Carolina. He's been a lobbyist, an advocate, run a company, and Udy's a really sharp guy who I think has his finger on the pulse of voters and of the popular opinion in a lot of very skillful ways.
Any other names that come to mind? And I'll tell you the four we came up with.
Well,
there are no wrong answers. You're sitting on a name right there.
Well, you know, I have to say, this is odd and awkward for me, but my colleague Chris Fitzsimon, who is leaving NC Policy Watch, who left yesterday, was his last day at NC Policy Watch, is someone who's been was a journalist, worked in the legislature, was a reporter, has led nonprofits, and I've worked with him every single day for the last dozen years. And, I mean, I wish more people could see what an incredibly insightful, hardworking fellow this guy is. It's the kind of guy who gets up at 4 o'clock every morning and reads every newspaper and every web story there is on North Carolina politics. It's a good day when you can tell Chris something he didn't already know, and he's an amazing force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, and I'm glad he mentioned Chris, because that makes me feel less bad about saying John Hood, who was my boss for
you
a number
partisan yeah, hacks, yeah, both. Yeah, I'm just
who was my
I'm
boss
just, yes,
for a number of years at the John Locke Foundation, but is now the president of the John William Pope Foundation, mm-hmm. still the chairman of our board. So you can read into that what you will. But John, and I would say the same is true with Chris, one of the things that helps them stand out is that they do have an ability to see what the other side is saying and understand the argument, and then sharpen their own counter arguments, which I think is lacking among a lot of the political class. I think you see that oftentimes with what has happened with the Republican General Assembly. Much of what they've done, people like, but the things that they've done that people really dislike, I think often have come about because they didn't have a good sense of what people who would not like their policies would dislike about them and how they could counter them. I you know, the whole uproar over House Bill 2, I don't think they had any inkling that that would lead to what it did. I think that they figured that the majority of North Carolinians, based on some polling that they saw, were going to be in favor of it. They were able to get some things in that bill other than the direct addressing of the issue of bathrooms. And they thought, okay, you know, this is a popular issue. We're going to get this out there. They didn't have someone within their leadership who would say, look, if we do this, this is also going to happen. You need to take account of that. And I think both John Hood and Chris Fitzsimon are wily enough, smart enough, and pay enough attention to the other side that they would be able to step back and say, look, this is going to open some doors that you aren't seeing right now. You might want to rethink this idea. And that is a sign of a good political mind.
Or at least have somebody who works with you and or for you that you're willing to listen to. I think maybe there are probably people in the Republican caucus who had doubts about some of the things that were about HB2, but I think the leaders maybe just didn't listen to those voices. So sometimes it's just listening to smart people who work with you and for you.
Governor Hunt was a name that came up when Loretta and I spoke earlier. Also, Carter Wren, longtime strategist for the late Senator Jesse Helms and Gary Pierce, mm-hmm. who was a longtime strategist and communications person, and also a former journalist, I believe, reporter 40 years ago. He worked with Governor Hunt, incidentally enough.
And they have a blog that they do together.
They do. They do, Carter and Gary. And they were on the podcast a long time ago together.
And I think Gary Pierce has taken down this blog post, but I've been a number of times invoked Pierce's law or Pierce's rule, which at one point he said something about how Democratic candidates don't have the luxury of saying everything that they believe when they're running for office. And I thought, oh, well, you know, when a Democrat says that, you have to be able to use that again. But I think he has since taken that post down.
Only other name that came up in our conversation I'll share is Jim Blaine, who's the chief of staff for Phil Berger. Certainly a very influential mind, if not one of the top political minds in North Carolina in present day. So we'll leave it there for now. If you have a thought on the top political minds in North Carolina, feel free to tweet at any of us. You can engage over email as well. Mitch Kokai is a political analyst with the John Locke Foundation. Rob Schofield writes for NC Policy Watch, part of the North Carolina Justice Center. Thank you both.
Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you, Jeff.